Well, now, this is the seminar and discussion on utilitarianism and the biologizing of ethics. Has everybody got the notes? Everybody has the notes. You do not have the notes. Now, what I've tried to do in these notes is to summarize some of the issues that arise from the contemporary attempt to base ethics on biology. And we concentrate, but not exclusively, on the views of Peter Singer, because he is one of the world's leading ethicists and is extremely influential in his views. And you can see the basis of his view is it is time for another Copernican revolution. It will be, once again, a revolution against a set of ideas we have inherited from the period in which the intellectual world was dominated by a religious outlook. Because it will change our tendency to see human beings at the center of the ethical universe, it will meet with fierce resistance from those who do not want to accept such a blow to our human pride. The traditional view that all human life is sacrosanct is simply not able to cope with the array of issues we face. The new view will offer a fresh and more promising approach. So what we have is a direct collision with the traditional view, which you might call the Hippocratic view and also the Christian view, that there's something very special about human life. And that specialness is being undermined in contemporary society by three things, really, mainly. First of all, the increasing availability of abortion for more and more reasons. Secondly, the question of the commodification of life, which raises all kinds of questions about the status of the early human embryo.
What is commodification?
Sorry?
What is commodification?
Turning something into a commercial product, do you see? In other words, you want to buy a designer baby, you want to do this or do that, you want to have cosmetic enhancement, you want to make sure your children have blue eyes and green teeth and all this kind of thing, you see. Commodification is going to become massive business. In vitro fertilization is expensive even, and so on. And then there is euthanasia. And each of those areas raises profound questions as to how we value life. I find it helpful to observe that ethical discourse occurs at four levels, usually. Some ethical theories you only have three, but essentially four. So let's start with a given ethical situation. There's a practical problem that has to be decided. There are practical judgments to be made in a given situation. That will be decided on the basis of certain moral rules believed by the person who's doing the deciding. Those moral rules will be justified by general principles. And finally, you reach the base level, and that is the ethical theory that underpins and supports the whole hierarchy. And you'll find, if you investigate any kind of ethical system, that this kind of thing is characteristic of all ethical systems. And what you will notice is that there's an enormous amount of discussion about the practical judgments, the general principles, and the moral rules. Where the discussion is missing is at the fundamental base level. What is the status and authority of the ethical theory that you're bringing to bear on any particular situation? After all, if you tell people to do things, you will inevitably raise the question, who said so? Let me illustrate those four levels perhaps for you from the Hippocratic Oath, which comes to us from ancient times. And I'm going to do it in the reverse order to the levels that I've given you here. So a newly qualified doctor, at least in the ancient world, had to swear an oath. That is, he had to call on the gods, to witness that he was solemnly promising to observe the medical ethics laid down in the oath. And simultaneously, he called on the gods to punish him if he transgressed this ethical code. So it was made obvious that the base and the authority behind the Hippocratic Oath was God of the gods. Then there is the general principle and aim of medical ethics: loyalty to the life of patients with determination to heal and to preserve life. And then there's the specific rule. And the Hippocratic Oath had several specific rules. Let me mention some things they included. The doctor must never knowingly use his knowledge and skills to harm or cause the death of anyone. Must never use any knowledge that he gained in the course of treating the patient to that patient's detriment. Must never betray the confidence of patients or disclose the details of their illnesses to strangers. That kind of thing, those general rules. And then there's the relevance of the basis and the general principle to the practical decisions. So a doctor would be faced with the question, in light of the Hippocratic Oath and its general rules, would it be ever right to kill a terminally ill patient in order to put the patient out of intolerable pain, and so on or so forth? Or suppose a doctor discovers that a patient is carrying a gene that will cause him in early middle life to develop a long, incurable, and eventually terminal illness. And if the patient's life insurance company get to know about it, they might terminate or refuse him a life insurance policy, and no other company would take him on. So if the insurance company offers the doctor a large fee to disclose the information, what should the doctor do in the light of his commitments to the oath and principles? That kind of thing is what we're talking about. And you will notice that in the Hippocratic Oath, the baseline was transcendent in a somewhat inadequate way. It was the gods. But the idea is there that somewhere there had to be a reference point outside of the system. And that, of course, is the very big issue. Must we have, for example, is one of the questions we may want to discuss, must we have a transcendent reference point in order to have any ethics at all? And I'm reminded, of course, in this, Dostoevsky and Nietzsche, the famous notion, if God does not exist, then everything is permissible. Now, that is a very serious proposition to debate. You notice what it's not saying. It's not saying that atheists cannot exhibit moral behavior. And it is very important, I find, when quoting Dostoevsky in public, to make that clear, because you will often run into the objection, you're saying that we atheists cannot be moral. That's an insult. Well, of course it is an insult. Even from a Christian perspective, it's an insult, because, you see, if Christianity is true, then we humans are moral beings with a conscience that is related to the law of God and character of God, whether we believe it or not, you see. So that we are moral beings. What we're saying is not that atheists cannot behave in a moral way. It's raising the question, do they have a basis for objective moral values? And that in turn raises the question of the existence of objective moral values. Do objective moral values exist? And there's this very interesting statement I came across recently by Mackey, who's a very famous atheist Oxford ethicist. If there are objective values, they make the existence of a God more probable than it would have been without them. Thus we have a defensible argument from morality to the existence of God. And I find that quite an interesting admission. that there's a defensible argument from the existence of morality to the existence of God. And one can then debate, and we may want to do that, do objective moral values exist? Does human behavior give evidence that there are such things? And you will find argumentation in the New Testament that runs along those lines. For example, Romans, early chapters of Romans, Paul says, you watch people excusing and accusing one another. If I hit you in the nose suddenly in the middle of this lecture, you'd probably say, that's not fair, you shouldn't do that. You automatically assume that there's a standard that transcends both of us. And Paul uses that as an argument, you see. He says the Gentiles, the pagans that don't know anything about biblical revelation and so on, the very phenomenon of excusing and accusing one another is evidence that they believe in a moral standard that transcends both of them. You see, and that is very important. And it's the starting point, actually, in C.S. Lewis, in Mere Christianity. He uses this argument from people accusing and excusing. Of course, he got it from Paul. But it is important that we see it is in Paul. The existence of moral absolutes is a very, very important question. And John Gray, who is in the same camp as Singer. He's a professor in London, and he's the professor of the history of European thought. And he's written a book that anybody interested in this field should read. It's called Straw Dogs, and it's a bestseller at the moment. In monotheistic faiths, God is the final guarantee of meaning in human life. For Gaia, do you all know what the Gaia hypothesis is? It was developed by a fellow of my own college at Oxford, James Lovelock. The idea that the earth is a kind of living thing and we need to look after it. A lot of things in the Gaia hypothesis, of course, make a lot of sense. But what Gray says is that for Gaia, human life has no more meaning than the life of slime mold. And Lovelock at the moment says the biggest problem with planet Earth is that it's suffering from an epidemic of primatomania. Too many primates, in case you haven't met that word before. Primatomania, I think it is. Too many primates. Loads of bacteria, and many people think that the insects will eventually win, and that's fine. Because there is no transcendent reference point to give human beings any special sort of position. I ought to mention at this point the notion of speciesism, which is the buzzword these days. Peter Singer says the thing that we need to get rid of is this notion that humanity is special, is distinct from the other animals. And the way they put it negatively is that we must give up speciesism, favoring one species above another. And he and others, particularly Gray, regard this as a relic of Christianity. And he finds it very amusing that many of the biologists who base some concept of progress on evolution have failed to recognize that the very theory they espouse cuts the ground under any possibility having a sense of progress coming from evolutionary theory. And he says what Darwin shows, finally, is that we are all the same, there is no difference, and we'll make no progress in the Western world until we give up this last vestige of Christianity, which is the notion that human beings are a special creation made in the image of God. So it is a war zone at the moment, and a very serious war zone. I regard this actually as potentially more serious than the science-religion debate on the status of the universe. It's related to it, and I suppose you could regard it as a subset of it. But the two big battlefronts, as I see them in apologetics today, and indeed in presenting the Christian faith to a secular world, are one, what is the status of the universe, and two, what is the status of human life? And the second question is really a subset of the first. Right, are there any questions so far or discussion? Because there's danger for me boring on endlessly and not contributing anything. And I see all these experts on ethics sitting in front of me like a phalanx of genii, and I would like to have their contribution. Alexander.
Just for clarification, John Gray, is that the same John Gray as that who has written books about men and women?
Yes.
Is it the same? Okay.
Well, and he's married Mars, women and Venus.
I think so, yes. No, wait a minute, have I got it wrong? The John Gray, Men and Mars Men, no, he can't be. He's an American. No, strike that out of the script here, whoever's recording it. I never said that. I told you we had experts here, you see. Right, any other comments people want to raise? Because please do, let's have a discussion. You know, I've talked and talked and talked. Yes, somebody wanted to say something back there? Yes? No? Jürgen, did you want to say something? Not yet. Yes?
I guess you're probably going to come on to talk about this later. On the bottom of page one, when you talk about the four different levels of ethical discourse, and you mentioned divine command theory.
Yes.
I was just thinking that, I mean, that sounds very arbitrary, I guess, to somebody who doesn't believe in God, and to have divine theory based on divine command. But it seems to me that if you just step back and say that the value relates to the only objective being who's there in the universe, and then you qualify that by saying he's morally pure and omniscient, that actually makes a lot of sense.
Oh, yes. Yes, I'm sorry, I meant to comment on that. The point there is this, that if you look at the ethical landscape, there is a set of ethical theories at this base level that are proposed for our consideration. And the dominant one today in Western secular society is utilitarianism, but we oughtn't to lose sight of the fact that there are others. There is virtue ethics that goes back to Aristotle, where you're thinking of the virtue of the person that does a good act. What is a good act? Well, a good act is one that's done by a virtuous person. Of course, that pushes the difficulty back, what is a virtuous person? But there's virtue ethics, which has been revived in recent days by Rosalind Hursthaus, for example. Her version of virtue ethics. Then there's Kantian ethics. And it is the opposite kind of thing from utilitarianism. Utilitarianism is a consequentialist philosophy. And ethical theories tend to divide themselves into two. There are the ethical theories based on consequences. You judge an act by its consequences. The opposite end of that spectrum are the deontological theories, from the Greek word deontos, one must. In other words, they're the theories that proceed from a command that says you must do this. And Kantian ethics is like that. His categorical imperative, for example, that lies at the heart of his ethics, where he's saying you should behave to others in such a way that you would be happy of extending the principle on which you act to everyone. That's the famous view of Kant. And that is regarded as a deontological kind of ethic. Divine command theory, or Christian ethics, if you like, fits into that category. And the reason I've listed them there is this, that in order to be true to history, there is no arbitrariness in having divine command theory, because it has been one of the most dominant theories in the history of ethics. And it's important, I feel, in discussions to put all the theories on the table. And that, therefore, in a contemporary society, gives you the opportunity to talk also about Christian ethics. Do you see what I mean? So it's very important to see that this isn't arbitrary. This is actually one of the theories. You see, Kant says one must. This is the categorical imperative. Well, then you can raise the next question, who says one must? And for centuries of history, it has been, the backstop has been God says that one must, so to speak. Oh, that's right. That is absolutely right, which is precisely why in this next thing I say that it is unavoidable. You cannot avoid a worldview commitment in ethics, you see. And if you don't find your base in God, you have to find it somewhere else, and you have to discuss where that base and authority is. So it removes, and I'm so glad you put the question that way, it removes the arbitrariness of it. And that's why it's important. I mean, I'm talking to you who are convinced Christians, but if we're talking to the outsiders, they say, well, now, here are the four levels of ethical thought. And the status and authority of ethics is vastly important, as you can see. Who says so? Now, the interesting thing is there are not many possibilities. There either is a God or there isn't. If there is a God, then God says so. If there is no God, there are only two other possibilities. You either base your ethics in nature, three perhaps, in nature, physical nature, down to the atoms and so on, and evolutionary theories, or you base it in the individual, or you base it in society. So in fact, the number of possibilities is reduced, and that's very helpful to get people to see they cannot just sit away on the edge somewhere. They've got to come in and position themselves in this. And I found that extremely useful. It's a very simple point. And then you can say, right, if there is a God, we would expect there to be a deontological ethic. And we can examine the various views that have been put forward, like Kantianism. If there is no God, then you're going to base your ethics elsewhere. And so we get down to things like utilitarianism. And the interesting thing is that utilitarianism is a deliberate attempt to found an ethic not based in God. And Rachels, who's a very famous writer, you see this quote here, "Gone are all references to God. Morality is no longer to be understood as faithfulness to some divinely given code or to some set of inflexible rules. The point of morality is seen as the happiness of beings in this world and nothing more, and we are permitted, even required, to do whatever is necessary to promote that happiness." And Jeremy Bentham, who's one of the key names in utilitarianism, there are three key names, David Hume, but primarily Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill. Nature has placed, notice the statement, this is the key statement, has placed mankind under the governance of two sovereign masters, pain and pleasure. It is for them alone to point out what we ought to do as well as to determine what we shall do. Now that is the root of much of the ethical philosophy that is being taught in our universities today. And it is worth investigating the problems with that. And I see people in this audience who are also interested in the scientific network and the question of intelligent origin for the universe. There is an exact parallel in ethical theory. An exact parallel, because utilitarianism is essentially a materialistic philosophy. It's rooted downwards. It's rooted from, it's a bottom-up rather than a top-down thing, you see. And it suffers, I would want to argue, and we can discuss it, from all the difficulties that materialistic explanations of biological life suffer from. Of course, there's parallels, but they're different arguments. First of all, there are two sovereign masters, pain and pleasure. Well, that leads to the first difficulty. How do we define pleasure? Should we seek amount of pleasure or quality of pleasure? And it was found very difficult, and you see for a moment, it's very difficult to get an index on a scale of 1 to 10,000 of what pleasure is. The impossibility of knowing the future is one of the massive difficulties of utilitarianism. Let me illustrate that for you so that we get it clear. Utilitarianism is a consequentialist philosophy, so that you measure the good by its consequences. So here's a man, and he decides that he is going to take his children to the seaside because it's a sunny day. So he does. They all go to the seaside. And when one of the children is swimming, a current suddenly catches it and it drowns. He couldn't foresee the future. Now, utilitarianism would judge that act as wrong because of its consequences. That imposes an intolerable burden on people, as you can see immediately. And it is a very serious flaw, as far as I can see, in utilitarianism thinking. The impossibility of knowing the future. Then there's the question of the significance of the individual. And when we're talking to medical students, we usually pose the following situation. Here is a hospital. The cardiac surgeon is suffering from kidney failure, and so is the professor of anesthetics. The professor of genetics, his liver is about to pack up, and to make matters worse, the chief physician needs a heart-lung transplant. The solution? Go out into the street and find a healthy young man, bring him into the hospital, take his heart and his lungs and give them to one, give his two kidneys to the other professors, and give his liver to the final one, so you've saved five people at the expense of one. What does utilitarianism say to that? Well, that must be good, because it's the maximum benefit for the maximum number of people. Now, it sounds a very trivial example, but actually, when you analyze it, it is an argument that is very frequently used, isn't it? I put it in a sharp form, but it is an argument that is even used in the New Testament, isn't it? It is expedient that one man should die. How often that has occurred historically, where you sacrifice the one for the many, or you sacrifice the minority. The majority decides it doesn't like the Jews, so it annihilates them. The majority decide they don't like intellectuals, as in Pol Pot, Cambodia, so they annihilate them. One tribe decides it doesn't like another in Rwanda, so it annihilates them. What has utilitarianism got to say to that? That is one of the major problems with his philosophy. It's not the biggest problem, though. The biggest problem, I think, is the one that was pointed out by David Hume himself. Now, you'll have heard me say nasty things about David Hume, and I don't take any of them back, but there is one thing that he put his finger on that I think is extremely important. The key problem is, and this is the one I focus on in my thinking, if there is no God, if God is out of the picture, and this is a sort of Dostoevsky-type thing. It's homing in on this point. Then, how can something that is ultimately mindless and impersonal and therefore amoral impose any sense of morality on us? That is the key question to be asked. And that's exactly parallel, interestingly enough, to the question that is raised in science, how can mindless processes generate information? You see, you're going from the impersonal and the mindless to semiotics in the argument on the intelligent design side. Here where you're doing an exactly parallel thing. You're going from the mindless and the impersonal to generate a sense of ought. And how is it done? Hume said it could not be done. And interestingly enough, the Nobel Prize winner Jacques Monod, in his famous book Chance and Necessity, said exactly the same thing. He said that all philosophies up into Marxism have attempted to get the ought from the is, and it is impossible. You cannot get an ought from it, an is. Now, this is such an important thing that I recommend one does a little bit of thinking about it, because John Searle, for example, has a very interesting article where he claims to be able to do it. And it's a bit like the whole question of trying to show that mindless natural processes can generate information. If you're a materialist, you'll have to show that it can be done. Now, exactly the same thing holds. If you're a materialist and you don't believe in God, you have to show how mindless, impersonal things can produce morality. You've got the identical problem to solve. Now, Rachel's, in his argument about this, does something quite subtle, and I want to analyze it. And it rests on the ambiguity of the word ought. And he gives an example. Here's a house that's on fire. That's the physical situation. If you want to save your life, you ought to get out of the house. So the physical situation imposes a moral obligation, is the argument. But that's false, isn't it? The physical situation doesn't impose any moral obligation. I haven't got a moral obligation to get out of the fire. It's simply saying, if you want to save your life, this is what you must do. There's no moral dimension to it. For example, if you want to catch the bus, you ought to leave now. That's not a moral ought. But it is amazing in the literature how frequently that device is used to say you can get from is to ought. Well, it falls down completely because, you see, there's no moral obligation for me to catch the bus unless it involves, say, a promise to somebody else, which is a moral dimension to start with. But in itself, that ought does not carry the implication of a duty to catch the bus. There may be 10 buses. You want to catch the next bus, you ought to go now. There's no moral element in that. And you'll find a lot of the argument revolves on doing a very clever sleight of hand to try to bamboozle you thinking one use of the ought is moral when it isn't. And I just flag that up because it occurs very frequently in the literature. The going from is to ought proves to be enormously problematic, which isn't surprising. Because the oughtness of things, coming from a biblical perspective, the oughtness of things is part of what it means to be made in the image of God, which is exactly the thing that's at issue, you see. Are human beings a special creation made in the image of God, or are they not? Now, I think some other people wanted to come in on this, so please do. Yes, that's right. And what happens with this kind of thing is that you start to get basic utilitarianism modified to try and take account of a lot of these things. And so you get a whole range of different views. But in the end, the consequentialism comes through and it does not completely deal with this problem. But you're right in the sense that people then try to come in and say, ah, but that's far too extreme. Let's modify it this way and that way and t'other way. You see, but you can't catch them all. And it's worth reading through the discussion between Smart and who else is it on utilitarianism. The book on utilitarianism that sells most, Smart, and who's the other author, do you know? It's Bernard Williams and Smart. I think you're probably right. I'll get it for you now. Smart and Williams, exactly that. 1998 is the latest version of it, and it is called, for those of you who want it, Utilitarianism for and Against. That is a very interesting little book on the topic. Okay?
John, I was just wondering about the historical context that utilitarianism was developed.
Yes, would you like to say something about it? The point on the historical situation in which it was developed.
Early 1800s.
Yes.
And society at that time, as it was developed in London, was at quite a low moral level. And we didn't have education, we still had slavery. We didn't really have any sort of structured health service at the time. So they were developing a theory that was trying to improve society, and they were both from a legal background. They were trying to work with politicians to bring in an improvement in the social structure. So if you started off from a very low basis of practical living, and you employed your calculus to maximise benefits and minimise harms, I can see how in that context it actually did improve society. We got education, healthcare, abolished slavery, living for the Christian. And I'm just wondering whether historically that's quite important, that now we're at a level in society, we're using utilitarianism rather than to deal with the injustice, we're actually using it to create benefits. I wonder what you felt.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for that comment. The comment is, for the sake of the microphone, is that if you look at utilitarianism in its historical context, where it started from a base where society was in a mess, and in a sense the majority were exploited by the minority, you can see that it has very attractive features, whereas nowadays, instead of being used as an ethical philosophy to increase the lot, the standard of living and the whole moral ambience of the country, it is now being used to create difficulty. I would agree with you, and I'm very grateful to you for making the comment, because my analysis here was really a negative analysis of Singer, and it is vastly important to say, and you now remind me to say it, that utilitarianism has very attractive features. Not only that, but in many of our decisions, in fact, in all of our decisions, it is important to be utilitarian in the following sense, that before I decide something, I ask myself, what are the consequences going to be? And that leads me to say something else in connection with ethical theory. It very rarely is an either-or. And the trouble is we like to pigeonhole things very, very simply, but that's not true. You'll find there's a whole spectrum. And in certain circumstances, utilitarian consideration, is this going to benefit the maximum number of people in this situation, is a very reasonable thing to do. And if I have a family of six kids and five of them want to go to the sea and one doesn't, well, you're likely not to take them to the mountains just for the sake of peace. Did you see what I mean? So we must consider consequences. The issue is, are there other things that can be considered, and can it be dangerous at the extreme edges going solely on that? And what we're doing here is in the extreme edges. But thank you very much for that. I agree with you wholeheartedly. Does anybody else want to comment on that? Because it's actually very important. Yes.
How the state laws right now, they are deontological, they are not utilitarianism, I would say. So actually this conflicts and would contradict in many points the state laws right now in Europe, wouldn't it?
Yes. The question is, the state laws are deontological, not utilitarian. Well, I think that needs to be explored a little bit. Once things get to the state of law, they tend to become deontological in the sense that the state says X. But when you ask, how did the laws get onto the statute book in the first place? It may well be that it's done on the basis of what society feels at the moment. And one of the problems that we're facing in legislation in Britain, for example, is precisely that. The attempt to get laws which appear to be supported by the maximum number of people onto the statute book, once they're there, they can be then used with discriminating effect. So I think you have to distinguish between the process that created the laws, because I'm afraid our politicians and our rulers, and this is a very important area, you see, if you've got no basis out there, transcendent, that overrules all, then one of the ways in which you're going to get your ethics is through the laws of the country. And it seems to me, as time goes on, that many people get their ethics simply from the laws of the land. What can I get away with? Because there's no other basis. Now, those laws themselves are deontological to the extent that if I break the law of the land, the police will turn up at the door and tell me you've got to go to prison. But how those laws got there, did you see what I mean, Alexander? There's the utilitarianism comes at the earlier stage. And the problem is when utilitarian thinking then becomes law and is imposed. Yep. Does that make sense? Yes, Adam. Yes.
For example, the pleasure of one group of the people may be on the cost of another group of the people, and it is probably more and more somehow come to the knowledge that we should somehow reduce our pleasure in order to allow the other to live.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, the comment about the environment and ecology, the Kyoto Protocol, and the appeal to nations to cut back, to reduce their particular pleasure so that more people can enjoy a hazard-free or a more hazard-free environment. That is absolutely right.
Actually, I know such a great person in Poland who just write a kind of the new ethics based on the pleasure, the amount of the pleasure is constant. So if you will take more pleasure for yourself, you will just live on the cost of others. Quite very extreme of this
ecological problem. That's right. You see, Smart, actually, whom we mentioned earlier, admits straight off that utilitarianism does, and I quote, have consequences which are incompatible with the common moral consciousness. But I tended to take the view, so much the worse for the common moral consciousness, you see. In other words, he is a consistent consequentialist. If that's the way it works and it offends common moral consciousness, well, that's fine. So that's part of the essence of the debate. And Williams, who rejects utilitarianism, and it might be just interesting to read you why his final line is this, but the demands of political reality and the complexities of political thought are obstinately what they are, and in face of them, the simple-mindedness of utilitarianism disqualifies it totally. The important issues that utilitarianism raises should be discussed in contexts more rewarding than that of utilitarianism itself. The day cannot be too far off in which we hear no more of it. Well, that's a remarkably optimistic point of view. All right? Any other things that people want to raise? I mean, that kind of thing leads me to say that one of the reasons for rejecting utilitarianism is utilitarianism itself. I mean, if you apply utilitarian thinking to the philosophy itself, you might find grounds for rejecting it, if you see what I'm saying. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. All right. So, any questions on the ought to is? Perhaps I can make it more neutral so that we really clear this up. If you're playing chess, suppose we're playing. I'm watching two people playing chess, and I say to them, "You know, you ought to move your queen now." Now you see, there's no moral obligation whatsoever there. There's simply, you know, if you want to get advantage, you ought to move your queen. But there's no moral implication in the use of the word ought. And I can't stress that enough. Language is so important, and a lot of people are not aware of the different uses of the word ought. And therefore, when they first meet these arguments, they don't know what to say.
That's where Kant's called
it, that is absolutely correct. Yes, that's exactly right. Yes, the questioner is drawing attention to the fact that Kant said this long ago and distinguished between hypothetical and categorical imperatives. And an example of a hypothetical imperative is this: if you want to get that square, you move your queen, you see. But it's not a categorical imperative at all. Now, the interesting thing is, if you analyze utilitarianism, in Bentham's view, you can tell which meaning of ought he's using. And it very definitely is the ought of moral duty and right and wrong. And it's important to say that because one has no quibble with the hypothetical imperative use of ought, but one has a quibble with the other use. So Hume did us a service. Singer, incidentally, has a look at the is to ought problem, and it's very revealing what he says. He says far too much time has been wasted on the is to ought problem that, according to him, has dominated the ethical discussion of the 20th century. He writes that disputes over the definition of morality and over the is ought problem are disputes over words which raise no really significant issues. And that's just not true, as an investigation of the facts show. Yeah. He says, disputes over the definition of morality and over the is-ought problem are disputes over words which raise no really significant issues. Well, I just think that is incorrect. They raise very, very significant issues indeed. Now, in spite of all of that, that's the next point. In spite of all of that, what Hume has said and all the difficulty, and if you look at the literature, it's vast. And as a little exercise, if you want a bit of fun, look up John Searle on the internet and is to ought and download his paper and see, can you spot the flaw in his argument? Searle, John Searle, the famous John Searle from Berkeley in California. S-E-A-R-L-E. He's a very interesting philosopher. He's the origin of the famous Chinese room thing, but I'm not going to go into that at the moment. In spite of that, the attempt still being made. The reason I have explained is, as I understand it, the obvious one, that if you're a materialist, you have to find a reason for your ethics. And so you've got to somehow do something. And James Rachels, who is a leading utilitarian thinker, his view is that you have to find a base in terms of natural science. In other words, that moral properties are to be regarded as identical with natural properties. Properties that figure in scientific descriptions or explanations. And so he identifies goodness with satisfying our interests. And this is a kind of preference utilitarianism. Our interests are explained in terms of our preferences, like protecting my eyesight is in my interest because I would have desires that would be frustrated if I didn't protect my eyesight, and so on and so forth. And of course that raises all kinds of questions. Do our ethical duties always coincide with what at the time we consider is our own interest? Stalin satisfied his interest by campaigns of mass liquidation, and so on and so forth. But Rachel still, and he bases his whole argument on the fire illustration that I mentioned to you, incidentally, tries desperately to get the ought from the is. So this problem is a very, very real problem. And it's worth us getting to know a bit about it if we're interested in these things so that we can talk to people about it. Because I find it's a marvelous discussion topic, the is-to-ought problem. Because it's one of the central problems of ethical philosophy. Okay. Now let's look at another basis in a similar vein and leading to similar problems. Francis Crick, giving the view of geneticists, science in general, natural selection in particular, should become the basis on which we are to build the new culture. And as for those who thought that science as such was value-free and had little to do with what concerns them most deeply, tomorrow's science is going to knock their culture right from under them. But Holmes Rolston, who incidentally won the Templeton Prize a couple of years ago, says science has made us increasingly competent in knowledge and power, but has also left us decreasingly confident about right and wrong. The evolutionary past has not been easy to connect with the ethical future. There is no obvious route from biology to ethics, despite the fact that we are here. The genesis of ethics is problematical. Well, that's putting it quite mildly. And you see, if you look historically at the attempts made to draw a pathway from biology to ethics, there are two big waves. The first one is what we call social Darwinism, and the second one is what we call sociobiology, which has now been transmuted into evolutionary psychology. But they are not quite the same thing, but almost the same thing. So the social Darwinism phase in earlier times, developed by Herbert Spencer, and that was the confidence that evolution gives a direction to progress. Evolution is marching ever upward. So that gives a direction of progress, and that coincides with morality, and somehow morality is going with the flow of evolution. Well, now, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to see the danger of that. Because if you end up, as they did, in certain circumstances, using the concept of the survival of the fittest and applying it in society, well, you can see, I needn't spell that out. There's a lot been written about it. But then, in the middle of the last century, the 1950s, 1960s, you have the sociobiological wave that coincided with the molecular biological revolution. And that's why you find people like Crick and so on getting involved with it. Very interesting, before we leave social Darwinism, to observe what Michael Ruse says. And he's a very influential philosopher of biology. Now, he has been utterly unremitting in his attempt to join ethics to biology. So it's all the more interesting to read what he says about the attempts before him. And this is how he puts it. He said, one ferrets out the nature of the evolutionary process, the mechanism or the cause of evolution. And then one transfers it to the human realm, arguing that that which holds as a matter of fact among organisms holds as a matter of obligations among humans. Ruse himself points out that once more the move from is to ought lies at the heart of the methodology of social Darwinism. And he said, traditional evolutionary ethicists seem to be supremely untroubled by charges of fallacious reasoning. They are even inclined to agree that the move from is to ought is fallacious, save only in this one case. And Ruse reasonably asks why they are so confident. Is there a missing premise? And he says, yes, there is a missing premise. Social Darwinians believe that evolution has a direction, that it spells progress ever upward, ever onward, getting better and better. Evolution leads us to good and to things of great value, hence it is the source of our moral obligations. And Ruse is very unhappy with that view. So it's interesting that the later biologists, Ruse's contemporary biologists, he's in Florida somewhere, I think.
He moved to Florida State.
Yes, Florida State from Guelph. I think he was in Guelph before, wasn't he? Yes. But you move on from that to the sociobiology situation. And you get people like E.O. Wilson and John Gray and coming on different sides of this question and attempting to base views on genetics. Like Jacques Bonneau and those who follow him. And unfortunately, as we've begun to see, that just as meaning and truth are casualties in the science-religion debate of a materialistic worldview, exactly the same thing happens here. It's not simply that morality is a casualty, meaning is a casualty, because you're dealing with exactly the same philosophy. Now, the problem is that if you start to base your ethics on genetics, you have two streams going. One seems to say that there is a genetic determinism, which appears to remove all possibility of morality. And then Dawkins makes this amazing statement that we should rebel against our genes. But on what basis? There's an absolutely brilliant analysis of this. Unfortunately, it's in German, but it's one of the best analyses that I've read. I say unfortunately, that's for those of you who don't read German. It's by a pupil of the famous German philosopher Spemann, and his name is Reinhard Löff, L-O-U-M-L-A-U-T-W. And in a book called Die Neuen Gottesbeweise, The New Proofs of the Existence of God, he takes Dawkins absolutely apart at this point and points out, as others have done, in fact, is what is this non-material part that enables us to rebel against the genes? It contradicts his whole theory. And the interesting thing is there seemed to be a double contradiction in Dawkins' thinking. He says we must rebel against the genes, and yet, look at the quote that I've got just before that. One half of them seems to be saying there's no such thing as good or evil at all. In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. Others are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. But when you start to spell that out, what was Stalin doing when he murdered 70 million people? Was he dancing to his DNA and Pol Pot and so on? You see. So you have this tension. And it's very interesting. If you take that bleak Dawkins view at the beginning, there is a point that's worth making. It's a side point to this whole debate, and it's this. When people tell me they cannot believe in God because of all the evil in the world, I say, all right then, there isn't a God. Where do you get your concept of evil from? To formulate the problem. That is worth thinking about. I've had many a fascinating conversation on the basis of that statement. Where do you get your concept of evil from? You see, and it's worth asking before we start to say, well, now there are these arguments and these arguments. Of course, there are many very important arguments. But the actual formulation of the problem, where do you get your concepts from? Any comments? Wer hat das gesagt? Yeah. Jürgen has just said everybody knows what evil is, and that's very true.
Yeah, just a quick comment. I know that Gould has said, when he passed away, that there's this double magisteria, the magisteria of science.
Non-overlapping magisteria, noma.
Because they're not overlapping, then, as we were talking earlier, religion is given the rest of everything outside of reality, physical reality, which includes morality. That specifically, in several quotes, he says that. It seems to me, would you say that, in a sense, by granting this ability of humans to rebel, that Dawkins said we have the right, or at least maybe we have the opportunity, to rebel against our genes, it's almost like he's suggesting, there is this program called X that is external to science. It's almost like he's sneaking around the back and smoking, when the teacher's not looking. he's going out and saying, well, yeah, I really want to rebel against my genes. And so he's creating this, he wouldn't even want to call it a religion. He might call it ethical philosophy. And there you have something to really work with, he would say, again, as he's smoking out back because he doesn't want to stay in line with the statement A that you quote.
That's right. Well, he's an example of what Jürgen just said. He knows what evil is, and he knows he's a moral being. And he knows that this determinism actually cannot be correct. But it falsifies a lot of his system, you see. His materialism starts to suffer because there is an admission that there's some immaterial, whatever it is. And other people have accused him of that, and not only Christians. Yes?
You've got a more Nietzschean phrase, the problem, I can't believe God because of suffering rather than evil. And people might, as soon as you point out the fallacy of evil, switch to saying, oh, I actually meant suffering. And because you say that the tyranny of the genes, the fact that we suffer, and start saying that suffering is bad and non-suffering is good, and this is because of our experience. I don't know if he takes that line, but
no, I don't necessarily think he does, but that's a question. Jürgen, do you want to say something about that to give me a rest on the suffering and evil question? You can say something, I think.
It's a quotation from this book of Reinhard Loeb that Dawkins is saying that we are determined by our genes. And then he says that the genes of Dawkins, Paul Dawkins, it would be good to write in his book that what he is writing is true. For then the book has more success if he writes that it's true what he's writing. And then Dawkins did write that what he's saying is true. And then so Loeb, his genes laughed.
Yes, that's right. It's very good that. I mean, he has got a marvelous sentence where he says, you know, this book is a product of a mimetic replication machine of English type by the name of Dawkins. And it's absolutely right. You apply the theory to Dawkins himself on what he's doing. Yes, Mark?
Well, the question is suffering. Couldn't you just adapt what you said and say, well, why is suffering significant if there's no God?
Oh, yes. It only shifts it back a simple step, I think.
Yeah, but push on this. That is the issue which people worry more about than right and wrong. If more people are aware of suffering, then we don't have to mean there's a major problem because there are currently damage-logical environment we live in. And people could say, well, genes have made us where we are, and now we have the capability to experience or not experience suffering, and therefore it's a new problem which has been created.
Well, I think in that context, it's worth asking whether they believe that suffering is wrong.
They probably change the categories from right and wrong to good and bad.
Yeah, but if I start torturing children...
Yes. Not evil, but bad.
It's not wrong.
It's not wrong.
Yes.
Bad.
Yes. So I have no moral duty not to do it. If it's... Why shouldn't I do bad? Yeah, that's right. Sorry, say that again, Jürgen. I think we missed it. Yes. Yes. You don't get out of it too easily, I think. Yes?
There are several cases of evil where pain is not, suffering is not involved. I can go to lots of individuals who don't have many contacts with many other people, put a bullet through their brain, dead like that, no suffering.
Yeah, that's right.
But evil acts.
Anything else on this?
Could you please repeat the quotation of Lewis? Lewis responding to Dawkins that he gave before?
Well, he gave it. He knows it. Jürgen, you tell him in German what it was. I haven't got it off the top of my head, Alexander. I'd have to look it up again.
I went to a discussion with Dawkins once, and he was talking about a number of the very bad things that had happened, including Nazi Germany and various things there, and yet proposing that there's no such thing as evil. And at the end, I sort of asked what he thought Hitler was doing wrong. He seemed to not really know how to answer it, and I asked him whether there was why a statement he said that he thought that we were progressive. and he was very quick to point out that he did not believe in absolute morality at that point.
So what measure did he measure better? What scale was he measuring on? If it's not an absolute scale, how would you know? It's a fascinating thing, isn't it? How do you measure progress if you have no sense of something that's outside moralities? Now he's comparing them, you see. It's fascinating that. Yeah. Please, yes, please. We want as much discussion as possible.
Just one question, yeah, because I think there is an attempt to establish ethics without God, really, which was made by Emmanuel Levinas, yeah, just that evil and good is somehow established on the existence of life of the other, of the person, yeah, which is out of your disposal. Yes, I think it's somehow connected with social contract.
Yes, that's right.
Construction of reality or of ethics. Yeah, that other, either it's animal or maybe a man, is not at your disposal. You can't have him as an object, except to kill him and to lose relationship. Something that is that could be base of ethics. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is somehow behind all those social construction, the sociological theory, and yeah, I don't know.
It is absolutely relevant. It's a very important observation, and it too deserves to be put in the table. I mean, because notions of social contract. Well, you're saying a couple of things there. One of the things you were referring to was Kant. Who said that no person should ever be treated only as a means. People should be treated as ends in themselves, in the sense that, you know, I use some people as means. If I get a taxi to the station, I'm using the taxi driver as a means to an end. What Kant said, you should never only treat people like that, you see. You should treat them as ends and valuable in themselves. But now the social contract thing is very interesting and very important, because it is often argued that this is a sufficient base for ethics and you don't need God. Well, one of the very interesting things about social contract is it works very well in a situation where you've got a group of units of almost equal power. You know, if we all have sort of equal influence and power, then if I don't treat you properly, I'll soon learn that you thump me back. Where it breaks down is precisely at the point where we've seen it break down frequently in history. That politicians in their infancy, and Hitler was one, would make contracts with nations and agree to treaties. But once he got the power, well then, if you come to me and say, if I got all the power, and you say to me, well, you ought not to punch me, I'll punch you back. You said, really? You punch me back, will you? But I've got all the tanks and the guns. Ah, but you ought not to. What will you now say? Simple. What? Simple. Yeah, exactly. So what? If the person says you ought to keep to the social contract, you've now got a problem. And that's where the problem has been revealed historically. It works very well, which is why in democratic societies, where they're roughly equal units, you see it in business. If you've got a lot of little businesses competing for the marketplace, like we used to have in England, little shops all over the place, it worked fine. Once you get one massive supermarket with everybody pouring into it, the little guys say, you oughtn't to do that. And they say, pardon, who are you? And if you've got no appeal to anything above the contract, you've got no appeal. So it just, the social contract, very good, but the problem is shifted just one step back. Why ought we to obey the contract? And if there's nothing transcendent, well then, somebody who has all the power.
I think what Emmanuel Levinas said, that it's the life of the being, of the other, it's not a contract in that way. But
it's a value.
It's the sanctity of this life. That it's out of your reach, out of your power. Maybe it's a source of respect or some basis.
Oh, yes, that's fine, if you believe that. But then if I ask the question, why ought I to believe that? We're back to the same problem. It's the same problem each time, really. And what is interesting is to compare the effects of these things. And I mean, the social contract one, I think, is very interesting from this point of view, that it works when people have equal power. And I constantly get it brought up against me. We don't need to consider God because of the social contract. And I just give them these scenarios. And there is no answer. Why should I? And if there's no God, and I've got all the power, and eventually there's a reversal, all I have to do is what Hitler did, blow my brains out. Now, so what? That's it. There's nothing else. Yes?
So the problem is that morality has always three components, like a value, then a duty, why I should act according to that value. If that duty is missing, then there's nothing. And the third point is necessary, someone who holds me responsible.
That's right.
If no one to hold me responsible, there's no morality, because these three points must be fulfilled for morality.
Yes, in the end, putting that very bluntly, it's hard to have a moral universe without a judgment. Because the whole doctrine, and this is perhaps worth mentioning in a Christian context, the whole doctrine of judgment is so positive because it means that the universe is moral and will be seen to be moral. Otherwise, our conscience and our desire for justice ultimately is a mockery. And that seems to me to be very important. Now, some people don't like the doctrine of God's judgment, but it is enormously positive because it's supporting, it's undergirding our basic knowledge of ourselves as moral beings. That's right.
Is that what William Golding is suggesting in Lord of the Flies? No judgment, no
gods. I suspect he might well have been, yes. Frightening book that is. Yes.
Is there a reason people will then make that same claim about God? You believe in God as being your true judge. You believe God is a good being. However, God does not have someone in authority above him. So you say he doesn't reduce you to be good.
Yeah. That's such an interesting question. You know what the parallel question is in the science debate, don't you? Who created God? It's exactly the same question in a different context. You see. And then you must unpack the underlying assumption, which is that there can be no such thing as a final absolute standard, you see. Just as the who created God question assumes that everything must belong to the category of the created, but that's exactly the point that's being made. There is someone who does not belong to the category of the created. And I used to find that, as I think I said in another context, but you may not have been there, rather amusing, in the Soviet Union in those days, because they believed often in eternal matter and energy. So their difficulty was, for them, the category of the eternal was non-empty. They just didn't want God in it. But they could conceive of something eternal, you see. So I would tend to respond to that in a very similar kind of way. Any more things to comment? Yes? Oh, we have to stop. Well, that's a mercy because I've got another talk tonight. Yes, well, any other comments that we need to make? We haven't got through this, but I wrote this just to stimulate you and then see which way the discussion went. The later bit of the argument goes through a few more things and then raises the question, there are moral absolutes. In terms of our own practical experience, we do recognize moral absolutes. And that would be something that we could say. The last quote I found very interesting from Francis Collins, who's the director of the Human Genome Project, just to contrast it with Crick's comment. It would be the purest form of hubris to take our rudimentary knowledge of our genetic code, craft theories about it with our puny minds, and declare that nature has once and for all trumped nurture and toppled God. This is the kind of arrogance that humans alone seem to possess and that genes alone could never explain, which I think is quite a nice touch, really. Well, I'm going to stop there because I think you've had enough at this stage of the conference. I've certainly had enough, and I've got another talk tonight, and I would like to ask you to pray for it in your peaceful and quiet times. But thanks for coming.